Views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Good evening. This is Onajim Wade, co-host of Race Treaty, a radio program that comes on airwaves electronically every Friday in between 9 and 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And when we say Race Treaty, we're referring to ICERD, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which was adopted in December of 1965. The parties that signed the convention said that considering that the Charter of the United Nations is based upon the principles of dignity and equality inherent in all human beings, and that all member states have pledged themselves to take joint and separate action in the cooperation in the organization for the achievement of one of the purposes of United Nations, which is to promote and encourage universal respect for and observation of human rights and fundamental freedoms for all, without distinction as to race, sex, language, or religion. Considering that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights proclaims that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights, and that everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set out therein without distinction of any kind, in particular as to race, color, or national origin. Considering that all human beings are equal before the law and are entitled to equal protection of the law against any discrimination and against any incidents to discrimination. It goes on to even talk about that United Nations condemned colonialism and all practices of segregation and discrimination associated therein. So that's a document that we would like you to refer back to, because that's a document that we are using for the basis of this program. And last week, we had illustrious guests to speak about the role they have played and what is being dubbed the Black Human Rights Struggle. We had a two-hour discussion, so we invite all our listeners to, in fact, look at our website, look at the podcast, the archives, so that you can really see all that was said. And it was a robust conversation. We processed the question, the relevancy of what is called the Human Rights Cities Movement. How is it relevant? What is the purposes of it? And to what extent had those individuals and organizations participated in that movement to date? The second question we had intended to also process was, how is their organization understanding and participating in what is now called the International Decade for People of African Descent, from 2015 to 2024. And we wanted to have each of the panelists give us insight and a response to that question and the relevancy of this decade. What are they planning to do? So we don't have the luxury of having the first guest, the first panel that was on the show last week to answer that question. But we do have two other guests that can answer it this day. One being Noel Didler, if I'm saying it right. My sister, if I'm not saying it right, please correct me. And she is in Jackson, Mississippi, connected to the work that's being done there, organizing the people, bringing these rights straight forward. So we'd like to bring Noel on and have her introduce herself and tell us who she is, the organization she represents, and then we'll get into some question and answers around the decade.
Hey everyone, this is Noel Didler from Jackson, Mississippi. So primarily the connection that I have with the ongoing decade work or the people-centered human rights movement that's kind of sort of building in Jackson in the context of global liberation work is that Jackson, with its amazing history of struggles and resistances that have come out of several different movements, have given kind of sort of rise to the question a few years ago around what is it that's happening here, and how are young people going to move forward. And these are questions that young people were posing to themselves with everything that was happening around the country and the larger voice or the collective voices they were able to see echo throughout the country through the use of media in the process. And as a result, right after Mike Brown, Mike Brown's killing, people in Jackson decided that they had to do something to show their solidarity with the ongoing national movement. And so we kind of sort of, I guess, created a short resistance, but decided and understood that was not enough. And so we decided that we needed to educate ourselves more around human rights and also kind of sort of understand not just human rights, but the people-centered human rights movement, and connect what we are doing to the work that we do to build platforms for economic justice, cultural justice, social justice, and other forms of work that is liberation-oriented. We decided human rights work is also as important. And so that is kind of how the Jackson Human Rights Institute was birthed at the Chokwe Lumumba Center for Economic Democracy and Development. It is a space where we have been engaging intergenerationally with our elders and young people and really young people in order to understand what human rights looks like for each of us in our own identities, in our own oppressions, in our own spaces, cultural spaces, and how we can give it a city-based voice and get our city to declare itself as a human rights city that honors the humanity of each human being. And it's a struggle to do that work when we have 85% black city, where we are constantly trapped for resources, and with the kind of systemic oppression that communities face. So we are in the process of doing that work, and we were able to host a working group of experts on people of African descent in Jackson in January of 2016 in a three-day tribunal process, and provide the testimonials on various aspects of human rights violations that are happening throughout the South, because the story of the South, again, globally ties into what it means to be in the global South, because Mississippi and majority of the Southern states kind of sort of happen to be the global South. So that is kind of the work that we are doing now. But that is, as most of you may know, the history of Mississippi and how, you know, when we say, I mean, it's popularized as the civil rights history, but it was, it has always been the human rights struggle, right? So there is that history that we are deepening our learning around, because we engage with elders and people who have engaged with elders who are no longer around, who are ancestors, and bringing all of that energy to fill us, to surround us, and to embrace us as we do all the work that we need to move our people's liberation agendas forward. That's kind of like a brief but long-winded way of introducing what's happening in Jackson. So I think I'll stop there if there are any questions or whatever.
Thank you. Thank you so much. When we're going to continue that inquiry, find out more about what's happening in Jackson. I'd like to now introduce the audience, in fact, a co-host of Race Treaty, Sister Dawoodi, who has been working, I think she has three or four of herself that runs around. And then we only can see one at a time, so we think it's just one of them. But I think it has to be at least four, because all the work that she does is just amazing. Sister Dawoodi, peace and blessings.
Hi, good evening, Brother Najee. Thank you for that beautiful welcome.
So please, for those in the listening audience who haven't had a chance to learn who you are and be introduced to you, please tell us about yourself and the organizations that you represent.
Certainly. I wear multiple caps. I am the chairperson of the NGO Committee for the Elimination of Racism, Afrophobia, and Colorism, which is located at the UN. I am also the founder of the Afro-Atlantic Theologies and Treaties Institute, also known as ATI, which is an interfaith group of members of the Afro-Atlantic tradition, that is, of voodoo, of candomblé, of santeria, umbanda, and all of the traditions of resistance that have enabled African people to survive and thrive in the Americas, in particular. I was also the founder of the DDPA Watch Group, which is an international coalition of organizations that are dedicated to upholding the principles of the Durban Declaration and Program of Action Plan. So I'm very happy to be here and joining you once again, my brother.
Thank you so much. And for those who have not had the pleasure of hearing from the founder of Race Treaty, the co-host, the chief co-host of this radio program, I would like our illustrious host, founder Robin Benton, to share some words with about whatever's on his mind and about tonight's panel.
Thank you, Brother Najee. We evolved out of the decade, and we've been scattered and kind of running around trying to figure out how we can, you know, really cover the decade from a global perspective. And there's some IT issues. We're working on it, and the decade is upon us. And I really, really want to thank the listeners, this human rights movement. The shift is about to take. I just want to thank you too, as you haven't talked to you recently.
Okay, sorry about those technical issues. Sorry to interrupt you, Robin. This is Scotty, the technical engineer. Your connection is pretty bad, and we just lost them. So sorry about that. It sounded like he had a bad internet connection. He was connected by his computer. I'll work with him in the chat to try to resolve his issues. Robin, let's give it a try again. We have you back. You muted yourself. Let me unmute you, Robin.
Yes, I'm back. Thank you.
Yes, if you if you're on the laptop,
difficulties.
Yeah, if you're on the laptop or anything, because I know you're connected by the computer. If you have any other browsers open or anything else going, that could disturb it. This is browser based when you call in through the VoIP, but you sound better now. Hopefully that'll resolve it. Please continue. Sorry for the interruption.
Thank you all for the updates and the pursuits under the premise of dismantling white supremacy. Thank you, Anaji. Take it.
Thank you so much, Robin. Sorry that we're having a few technical difficulties in terms of hearing you clearly. Hopefully that can get worked out. But always, the listening audience always know that Robin is always in there, you know, pitching from the left side, the right side, the front side, the back side, wherever is, you know, is needed, he's there. I'd like to turn back to Sister Noel and ask her to, we met about a month ago in Boston at a conference looking at human rights cities movement, and I was very happy to meet her and see the role she's playing. And just to give a little bit of background, was back, this is 2017, so probably in 15, there was a meeting held in Pittsburgh where one of the organizers, Vicky, decided to bring some scholars and some activists together to say, okay, let's see what's happening around the country, even around the world, where people are taking on the approach to bringing human rights into their cities on a local level. That is the local municipality opposed to the Congress. Then we met again in May of 2016 in Washington, D.C. I wasn't at the first one. I didn't know about it. I did attend the second one in Washington, D.C. and became a member of the steering committee. And then this, the third major meeting was that of in Boston at a law school, a Northeastern Law School, where Kate gave a striking presentation and got my attention. We would also want to note that it will be in Jackson in 2018 that we'll have the next major meeting. There'll be some sub-meetings along the way, but we really are gearing towards that meeting in Jackson, and we want to organize in such a way that it becomes a people's movement, not one of scholars, not one of academicians, but really about the people. So talk a little bit about your involvement with the human rights movement that you might didn't say before, and what are your expectations for the 2018 Human Rights Cities gathering in Jackson?
So the 2018 Human Rights Cities gathering I wasn't at the previous meeting, but in Boston, we kind of sort of tried to work through a vision for what our expectations as a national committee could be for 2018. But the question I've had and the ask that I had at that time was to have a committee of people who live in Jackson and also suburban people, basically be part of that planning process to whoever is attending the gathering to co-create the space to share with everybody else what a human rights city's vision looks like for Black and brown people in the South. So to me, that is the front right center of everything. How does it even matter? What does it mean for a Black person or a brown person, people who have been systemically oppressed and people who have been marginalized in the South, to even think about human rights when their daily needs are not met, right? So that's kind of sort of the way in which we had that conversation. We started framing that conversation as a national coordinating committee up in Boston last month, but the we are in the process of gathering people in the southern region who might be part of shaping how they want to utilize that gathering space as a way to lift the voices of the South yet in another platform, because conferences for the most part are about academic regurgitation, or for the most part where people come in to, you know, engage in networking and connecting and moving along. But I think there should be a sustainable understanding of these spaces through which we consciously build relationships, and we try to sustain these relationships with the larger vision for liberation. So can connect everything to this huge liberation ecosystem, right? So how does it look like for Jackson with everything that's happening to play that role of the hostess, the host, in having different folk come in and share their vision for the human rights cities, and also for the southern folk to share with the rest of the folk that are gathered what is the southern reality, or what is the reality of black and brown people, and does it, human rights cities, is that a reality? How does it matter? So that's kind of what we are trying to grapple with, and it will be a collective decision that will be made on what we want to share in the space and how we want to envision the three-day gathering to be, and honoring the local history and honoring elders, and also making sure there's space for every voice, and also being intentional about who we are and the legacy that we have to carry with a lot of accountability on our shoulders. So 2017, this year in May, we are going to have an election, a critical election for the city of Jackson, in which Chokwe Antar Lumumba is running, and he is the people's candidate, as we call him. And so there is that work, the electoral politics work, which is also part of the larger political project that we, majority of us, are engaged in. So to us, that also plays a key role into how 2018 Human Rights Cities vision will be shaped. The win of the election plays a big role in that. So that's also something that was discussed at the national team meeting up in Boston last month.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And we want to focus on the centrality of this statement, and that is, we can recall that in 1860, former enslaved Africans numbered close to 4 million. We know that 97.1% of African people in the United States at that time, in fact, were in the South. So it's not by a chance, but in fact, logical reason, that the five states were declared the Republic of New Africa. And also mm-hmm. what we're seeing, the trend, is that more black people are returning to the South in larger numbers than we've seen in the last, you know, I guess three or four decades. So there is a renewed call for looking at the centrality of our people in the South. We have worked the land. Indeed, we are a domestic nation on the land. And speaking of land and speaking of nationhood, I want to now turn to Sister Dewey to speak to us about the relevance and significance of the International Decade for People of African Descent, and place that in context for us. And please give yourself enough time to give the audience a full breath of what this is. And we know that there's three major themes, the three themes of recognition, justice, and development. Sister Dewey.
Thank you. It's fascinating to hear other sister on the phone and talking about
the human rights cities, because it's an excellent way of kind of grounding us in the day-to-day struggle, and some of the things that we can do on a practical level that is, you know, has some kind of immediate effect and impact on what happens to our lives. On my end, particularly working with the NGO Committee for the Elimination of Racism, Afrophobia, and Colorism, in, otherwise known as CRAC, working at the with non-government organizations, that's what NGO stands for, that are combating racism, it sometimes feels so abstract, but our movement comes out of a bigger historical trajectory where by in the late 20th century, people of African descent in particular, but other people who had been colonized by the West, determined that human rights was a critical issue and that the biggest scourge in the world for us that was preventing our capacity to move forward as people and to be recognized as human beings are the issues of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and other forms of intolerance. Another form of intolerance would be the issue of caste, for instance. Caste, even class, or when one belongs to multiple groups, you know, you're a woman, you're a Latina, maybe you're gay. That becomes an aggravated form of discrimination, because all these groups are marginalized. But in coming together as a movement, and it is a movement that really came out of this country, but it was an international one, and it manifests itself in different ways, a grassroots movement here in the United States, a movement through governments, say, in the Caribbean. Black and brown people determined that, again, we had to put an end to this. And so this World Conference Against Racism, the WCAR, took place in Durban, South Africa. And a number of important outcomes have come of this, primarily the Durban Declaration and Program of Action Plan, which is a comprehensive plan that all member states of the United Nations have been asked to uphold, certainly morally, but more importantly, we've been asked legally. It hasn't, the Durban Declaration hasn't been fully ratified by all nations, including, sadly, the United States of America, which has the second largest population of African descendants outside the continent. And the Durban Declaration is important for all of us, not only because it is yet another international instrument that supports and upholds CERD and other laws that are intended to, international laws that are intended to uphold the humanity and their rights and recognize the sovereignty of Black and brown folks. But the Durban Declaration determined that the transatlantic slave trade was a crime against humanity, and it is also opened the door for reparations. Some of you may recall that under the Bush administration, under Lisa Rice and Colin Powell were in attendance at Durban. They walked out of that process because they claimed it was racist and it was anti-Semitic, really. And in fact, the reason that these individuals walked out and the U.S. walked out and has boycotted the Durban process since the year 2000 is 2001 isn't so much about being anti-Semitic as much as it was because of the demand for reparations. So this is a critical issue. It's part of the battle, and it's a long and ongoing battle that we have. The movement for reparations and for full recognition of the Durban Declaration has been undermined by all kinds of forces under this, you know, this claim that it was an anti-Semitic conference. In a lot of ways, we could say it had been eviscerated. There was a lot of character assassination, a lot of instances in which organizations were defunded, a lot of effort made, especially by the global North and countries like Canada, again the U.S., France, to Israel, of course, to prevent the movement of Black and Brown people from really changing the nature of the world order. But nonetheless, we've prevailed. There have been some setbacks, but we have prevailed. We've prevailed in the sense that we've created a greater solidarity among Black and Brown people. We've prevailed in terms of making sure that the fight for reparations continues, and it's taken steps such as the creation of the International Year for People of African Descent, which was in 2011, and then the process has continued into the creation of the International Decade for People of African Descent, which runs from 2015 to 2024. Now, the important thing about the decade is that every single UN member state, including the United States of America, has ratified and upheld a General Assembly a resolution that is intended to really alter the lives of people of African descent globally. So again, the theme of recognition, justice, and development are what was articulated. And it's important that we understand what recognition means. Recognition means isn't just, you know, I see you, I know who you are, but recognition means that the state sees the kind of agency a person has, you know, that African descendants are actors in whatever state or nation that they are a part of, and it doesn't matter if we are the majority or the minority, but especially if we are the minority, that we are recognized as human beings who have a right and the ability to alter the course of policy, to express our sovereignty in the state and act as agents of change, and the state has to recognize our existence and our right to make changes, especially if they don't act in our favor. Justice, I think we all understand where that is. Justice is about creating a space of balance and in equity for all of us as African descendants. And the spaces where the justice has to be manifest ranges from everywhere from but better education for people, an education that includes our histories. There's a lot of conception, a misconception that it's only in the United States where we don't know anything about ourselves as African descendants. But in fact, in the Caribbean, in throughout the African continent, in Europe, where there is a major not only human rights and civil rights movement, but major Afro-descendant population, Afro-Europeans, there's nothing in the history books. There's nothing in the textbooks of children that allows them to know something about their history and who they are. This is a manifestation of injustice. And so, justice is there as much as it is in our courthouses, as much as it is on the streets fighting against police brutality, because that too is a universal problem. And then development is the right to determine what our destinies, what our futures are. What will it look like on a personal level? How do we develop ourselves? Infrastructures that will allow our economies to grow, trade deals that allow our economies to thrive and not be subjected to corporations, transnational corporations, and the whims of globalization. Development in terms of intellectual growth, spiritual development. All of these, housing as a manifestation of development. So the decade with these three things, again, recognition, justice, and development, is intended to take the inequities that and the disparities that exist in all of our societies and alter things so that people of African descent can be fully integrated, fully recognized, fully embraced by the states that we live in. And it's all a grand and noble idea, and it's wonderful that our respective countries have agreed to this, but at the end of the day, it is up to every single individual in every single country. Where we find people of African descent, it's the grassroots, it's the community based organizations, it's the non-government organizations who have to make that fight. We have to be out there building human rights cities, writing legislation, connecting to our elected officials, demanding that our government provide the resources that we need to fulfill the objectives of the decade, whether it's space, whether it's money or personnel. These things have to happen so that we can see some substantive change towards self-sustainability, towards liberation, if you will, of African descendants. So our NGO, the CIRAC, again, the NGO Committee for the Elimination of Racism, Afrophobia, and Colorism, has for over 15 years fighting to uphold the Durban Declaration and Program of Action Plan and push forward the Durban review process. And we're going to continue to do so. But I got to tell you, there are there's some serious issues that we face. You wouldn't think that we would be encountering certain problems that we do, such as systemic and structural racism at the United Nations itself. But in fact, we do. Some of the agencies at the UN have not been doing everything that they could be and should be to allow this agenda to move forward.
Thank you so much for that. A very broad spread of these issues and some of the challenges that's before us, even with the very organization that's promoting the decade, is slow moving, to say it politely, and obstructionist, I guess, to say it more boldly. So I want to now turn to the South again, to Sister Noelle, and ask her the African decade, the international decade, be relevant to you there in Jackson?
So as a Dalit woman from South India making Jackson home, I don't definitely see it's my place to speak for people of African descent. In Jackson, Mississippi, I'm the Deep South. I am an ally working along with my communities because Jackson is home, and this work is definitely what I believe in. And as Ed Whitfield says, people are sacred. So these are my people, and they are sacred to me. And our liberation work is definitely sacred and necessary. So I cannot answer, but there wouldn't be somebody on the show next time from Jackson, Mississippi, I think, who would be more qualified to respond to that.
But I appreciate your humbleness in terms of the question and giving the right to the people who occupied that land for what, three centuries now. But as a black woman, you know, that happens to come from one part of the earth that we call India, right? We are brothers and sisters. The fact that you live with the people, among the people, you struggle with the people, I would want you to accept our granting of permission for you to expand a little bit more on that, because the time I met you and the speech that you gave at Boston showed a tremendous insight to the needs of the people and where they are headed. And I do would want you to spend a little bit more time on that response, if you'd be so kind.
Right. So thank you for that. So the decade in itself, to me, as I'm learning from several people in Jackson, who have been part of these processes globally and locally too, is a necessary one for us to recognize as a tool to move the agenda for the, you know, reparations forward, and to create so many levels of understanding around it, but locally, because a UN or anything related to UN, it translates very differently from my understanding in the United States as opposed to other parts of the world. So there is UN, and there is the work that goes around to hold UN accountable, right? And that is how the decade came about. And several people have been working for a lot of time and for years, as the sister was saying earlier, to make that even possible. So it's important to respect and recognize the effort of elders that have gone into getting UN to recognize the decade, and to see how we can, in our communities, do the work necessary in these 10 years to move the agendas of the communities, local to global, forward. And to me, that is how I see what has to happen. And the first thing I see around that for us in Jackson is looking into the history of human rights in Mississippi and the work that has been getting done for several years in order to understand human rights and frame civil rights as human rights, and to look at the ongoing human rights violations in Mississippi and in Jackson particularly, and to create a city that is conscious about how we look at each other's humanity. So there is a piece around education that needs to happen, and then there is a piece through which we connect human rights and all the struggles that we are going through, and framing all of that and creating the language that the people want, not putting it in an academic frame or trying to come up with terminology that alienates people more times than bringing them together, kind of. So that is a lot of work that we have to do. And then understanding the culture of people in a particular place. And then sometimes maybe we don't have to use the word human rights or to even frame it as human rights, but it is part of the work that we call liberation. And how all of that play into what is happening in the city of Jackson right now, and what's the history of Jackson that has led to the conditions that people live in right now, and how are we doing what we need to move people out of these struggles into a place where they are able to make the decisions for themselves. As the Malcolm X grassroots movement always talks about self-determination, and that is the organization from whom the processes such as Cooperation Jackson have been birthed through, so to which I'm connected with the majority of the work in Jackson. So to me, that's very important that we understand what self-determination looks like for people of Jackson, and how is it being dreamed about collectively, and how it is being manifested collectively, and what is the work that has to go into that, and then what is the kind of what are the different ways in which we can use the spaces that we have access to create a learning process or several learning processes where we engage people across generations in order to come to an understanding of a collective work that speaks to us, right? So to me, that is what I see happening in everything that's happening here in Jackson particularly. Again, with since I taught at Jackson State University for the last 11 years, and it is a historically Black school. And so to me, that is a space where we can, engage young people with the elders in the community and create a learning around who the people are and what the real people's history is, and tie in all the pieces through which the kids are able to critically imagine for themselves the possibilities around how they want to live their lives. And of course, that comes with the framing of human rights, and that comes with the framing of self-determination, that comes with them imagining economic justice, economic democracy, social justice, and a bunch of other things. So those are the spaces, public education, right? That is one way where we can make those inroads. And then, of course, different kinds of cultural spaces, and then engaging local artists and, cultural workers and faith spaces. And how do we, create that level of collective consciousness using what we have as human resources and institutional resources? And, books are just one way of doing it. Art, different ways, right? There are several ways we can do it. And so I can only speak for a couple of the organizations and the work that we are doing through those organizations, but to me, the broad-scale work that's happening across the city through various organizations and institutions and community groups, we may not speak the same language or share the same kind of understanding around issues, but I think all of that also speaks for who we are and how it is in Jackson.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you about the Jackson Worker Ownership Cooperative Conference that happened there. Is it 2 years now?
Jackson Rising.
Yes. Please tell us about that. It wasn't too much popularized and discussed in the North, but do share with our audience what was the purpose of the conference, what happened there, what were the results, and what are the forward thinking and forward plans for that conference?
So Jackson Rising was a conference. My suggestion to those who are not familiar with what's happening in Jackson with its recent political history is to study the Jackson-Cush plan that was put together by the Malcolm X grassroots movement, and to understand the process through which RNA's vision for the southern states and for liberation of Black people in the South played a major role in how the Cush plan came about. And one of the the election of Chokwe Lumumba as city council person and also as a mayor. And then when Chokwe became mayor, one of the ways in which they wanted to build the economy in Jackson was to create an understanding for people in the city around worker-owned cooperatives and also other economic means through which they wanted to create a shift in how people thought about themselves and their communities and the resources they had access to in the community. So as a result, the conference or Jackson Rising gathering was conceptualized across the nation and with a lot of other people who were part of the conceptualization from Canada and other places to actually people connected through the movement. And so it was supposed to be organized on May 1st and 2nd of 2014 in Jackson. And the city was supposed to be the major sponsor of the conference, and Jackson State University was going to be the physical host conference space. And a month before the conference, Chokwe transitioned. And but the conference happened. We had about 500 people attend the conference and attend the conference and basically learn from each other the different ways in which the cooperative movement has been building economies, the black economies in the South, and the history of cooperative movement in the South. And Jessica Gordon Lemhart, who wrote the book Collective Courage, she was also there, and Fund for Democratic Communities, and Southern Reparations, Southern Reparations Loan Fund, John Zippert, and Federation of Southern Cooperatives, and a bunch of other people who have been historically doing this work and currently doing this work were also present there and guiding the different processes that took place at the conference. And at that, I mean, I guess symbolically, that's where Cooperation Jackson was birthed, through which, we are trying to build movement around worker-owned cooperatives in the city of Jackson. It's only 2 years old. We are still in the process of, learning and organizing and educating and motivating ourselves and the community that we are located in to, transition in a just way towards more regenerative processes of sustaining, building and sustaining wealth in our communities. So that's the story behind how Jackson Rising came about, like a brief history of what I saw take place. There's a much larger, deeper, and complex story that exists that ties in the various aspects of the Black radical struggles. It would be better if somebody else speak for it, but Ed Whitfield is here with me, who is from Greensboro, North Carolina, and who also happens to be the chair of the Southern Reparations Loan Fund and one of the founders of the Fund for Democratic Communities, who can speak more on that, if that is okay.
Well, that is certainly okay, but before we bring him on, I would like to announce to the listening audience that Sister Noelle has joined us as a co-host of the program. So this is the first time you're hearing her voice, and you can see that she's already a dynamite organizer because she has someone else on the program with her right now. We'll give you a clue of how she's always making those connections and giving people a bridge to what's happening in Jackson, and also supporting us in our various cities around the globe as we struggle for our liberation. So please, go ahead and introduce this gentleman to this listening audience and see what is it that he would like to comment on.
So this is to the listening audience and to the co-host. This is Ed Whitfield, who is a current resident of Greensboro, North Carolina, originally from Little Rock, Arkansas, a good friend of mine. And I refer to him as a radical economist, but he's much more than that. He's a blues musician and a bunch of other things. So here's Ed Whitfield for you.
Hello, everyone. I'm honored to be able to be a part of this conversation. There was one thing I just wanted to insert. One aspect of the human rights decade is this question of development, and it just strikes me as really being a core of our efforts toward exerting our full humanity in the world, our own capacity to in ways that are meaningful, that are both culturally and spiritually meaningful for us to meet the needs of the people in our community and elevate the quality of life. And for this, you know, the development work that we do is crucial to actually be able to build institutions and structures that are capable of meeting our needs. And this is the work that I'm deeply involved with. I think about 24/7 and working with the Southern Reparations Loan Fund to be part of the financing structure for financing that kind of sustainable development that we're capable of engaging in.
Can you expand upon that? This loan fund, can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, one of the outgrowths of the Southern Grassroots Economies Project that we started several years ago was to talk about how will we find financial resources for some of the cooperative development work that needed to take place in the South. There's been a co-op movement in this country for a very long time, and in very recent years there's been a worker co-op movement that a lot of people have heard about. But the deep, long, and rich history of the cooperative movement goes way back past that. In fact, it goes back even further than the formal co-op movement that a lot of people will date as having come out of England in 1844. There's a lot of cooperative economics that our communities have been involved in around the world for a long time. But one of the things we're trying to rebuild in this current period is the self-reliance of people building economic structures that are capable of meeting the needs and elevating the quality of life in our community. A lot of the stuff we've done, particularly since the IRS and the 501c3 legislation that's come into existence, is do things that are dependent on grant funding to operate. And one of the things a lot of us realize is that in the long run, we're not going to build the kind of independent, self-reliant movement of our people on the basis of being funded by foundations, some of whom, you know, pretty deeply support what we're doing. Others can only do it in a very superficial way. So we're going to have to build economic structures that meet our needs and elevate the quality of life. These need to be cooperative structures that are owned in common and that are democratically run and democratically organized and democratically owned. But in order for this to take place, we need to have financial institutions that are capable of recognizing the importance of that kind of ownership. And so the principles of the Southern Reparation Loan Fund are to be radically inclusive, to engage in non-extractive finance, and in particular, to see our success as maximizing community benefit rather than maximizing profit. And by radically inclusive, we mean making loans to folks that other financial institutions wouldn't even dream to loan to, because it's not on the basis of your credit score or the amount of collateral you have, but rather on the basis of the viability of the project that you are working on and how much it maximizes benefit to the community and its capacity for succeeding. So, you know, we have a lot of genius out among our people. We're capable of conceiving of new products. We're capable of building things. We're capable of doing all kinds of stuff to meet our needs and, again, elevate the quality of life. We need access to some of the resources that are systemically taken and have been extracted from our community that were produced by our labor but are being held somewhere else. The idea of the Southern Reparations Loan Fund is to start drawing that back into the community in the form of a revolving loan fund where it stays in the community. We'll make loans to entities that will, on the basis of the financing they've gotten, increase the productivity of the people working in them so that they can pay the loan back and still retain the additional earnings that come from the fact that they increase their productivity because they have access to
Whitfield, resources. Mr. Whitfield, this is your technical engineer, Scotty, and Black Talk Radio platform manager. If you could just hold your thought while we take this quick station identification break, where you can share even more information. But I do think that's very important what you're talking about. Brother Anaje, do you want to take us to the break?
Yes, this is Anaje Mwene, co-host of this program, Race Treaty. And to be on this program, you have not only have to have ideas, you have to be an organizer. And you've heard three of them already tonight. So stay tuned. We'll be right back and call your friends and families and have them come on as well. This is Anaje Mwene. And this is Race Treaty.
Make Black Talk Radio your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new
you
millennium.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
This is Anaje Mwene. I'm back with Race Treaty with our guests. And we have, well, they are our guests, but also they are co-hosts of Race Treaty. Sister Dawoodi Garcia, you've heard her speak earlier. She'll be coming back on right after Ed finishes his, and I don't know Ed's last name. You have to help me with that. He's speaking about economics. He's talking about self-reliance. Many years ago, I used a rubric that Mari Evans said, if you make a people mystified, dependent, subordinate, and powerless, you have in fact colonized them, you've controlled them. So the liberation struggle, of course, is making people educated, self-reliant, self-affirming, and self-determining. And that is the struggle which we are still, in fact, involved with. And Ed has given us insight to how do we finally move from the first stage to the second stage of becoming self-reliant. And he's brought to our listening audience this reparations loan banking, this vehicle that could do that. So, Ed, please continue where you left off in terms of giving us insight to the structure that you've conceived of.
Okay, I want to just reiterate the fact that all of our folk in our communities are capable of being productive. We are almost called upon to forget that fact when so many of us are left without having access to the means, to the situations, to the places in which we can be productive. So we're left to feel non-productive and as though we need to be given some money, transfer it from somewhere else, just give it to us so that we can consume the things that we need to live. But we're in fact capable of being productive, and in fact that great pile of wealth that we are calling upon to get some back out, we largely created. It was the labor of enslaved Africans mainly in the South, mainly in Mississippi and Texas and Arkansas and Louisiana, that produced the wealth that financed the Industrial Revolution. So we deserve it back. That's the kind of basic demand of reparations. But the form in which we deserve it back, it would do us, the best good. And people can have many ideas on this. But I think the most important role that wealth can play as we call for it back is toward development, toward our creation of sustainable entities where none of us are hungry because we produce the food that we need to eat, where none of us are cold because we produce the shelter we need to be in, where none of us have to run around naked in the wintertime because we produce the clothing that we need to wear, where we have transportation and access to energy that we are capable of producing. And we're all capable of producing more than we need for ourselves, and the surplus that we create and produce ought to be stored in such a way that it is available to the future and generations, but also so that it's available to elevate the quality of life and take care of those people within our community that are either too young or too old or too infirm to be productive right now, even though they too are productive and sacred, valuable people. So that's the idea behind, you know, the kind of economic vision that we hold with the Southern Reparations Loan Fund. So we're looking to help people build a kind of structure that can be sustainable. And one of the things that's happened, though, is that at some points we have lost contact with some of the constructive skills that are needed to build the kind of businesses that we need to have. And so for that reason, a lot of times, a lot of technical assistance is needed. If you think about it, the whole reign of the Industrial Revolution has meant that there's a lot of very rapid production of a lot of stuff. Huge amounts of the stuff that are produced and sold in this country is junk. It just really is junk. But it's sold cheaply. It's widely available. We are enticed into wanting it because our children are asked to sit and watch cartoons on Saturday so that they can all think that they need a G.I. Joe with a kung fu grip, even though no child in the world needs a G.I. Joe with a kung fu grip. But they will make you think they need it because those were on the TV commercial. We need to recognize that the core of our needs are around food, clothing, and shelter. That we need to be able to produce that for ourselves in such a way that it's not some developer's idea of how to gentrify our neighborhood and change low-cost housing into expensive housing so that they can flip it and make a bunch of money that they pocket, but rather so that we can make sure that our people are adequately clothed, housed, and fed through the structures that we own that retain any kind of profit and benefit for our communities. And so that's what we're looking to provide technical assistance as well as finance for, and do it in such a way that the money's coming back into the loan fund get to recirculate and be loaned out again. You can't do it in such a way that the money goes out and never comes back. But since we are capable of being productive, we are capable of building sustainable businesses, this is what we have to fight, and that's the standard that we have to hold ourselves to as we do this kind of development work that needs to be done in our community.
Mm. Thank you. Sister Dawoodi, you've been listening very patiently to this conversation, and given your travels, being, you know, firmly connected to Haiti, the birthplace of our revolution, and seeing the suffering of our people, your people there, how practical is this idea of having this reparation loan fund? And you've seen it, you know, different attempts of self-reliance in various places. You were a traveler in terms of the continent, in fact, all over the world. But give us some sense of how realistic is this, and what obstacles do you see that might be put in our way? Because we know that everything, all revolutions are based upon land, and we know that the northern countries, the western countries, have usurped the rights of land, of our land and our resources. So in today's international economy, how realistic is this, and what obstacles might we face?
Well, I've been enjoying listening to this conversation, and I look forward to meeting our brother at some point. But as I was listening, I felt very much like, we could be talking about anywhere people of African descent are. We could be talking about Haiti. We could be talking about Jamaica. We could be talking about Guyana. We could be talking about Togo or Kenya. We could be talking about anywhere we are, because this issue of, again, being self-sustaining, of being independent, of creating our own infrastructures, of doing for self, is something that those of us who come from so-called developing third world countries have always had to do. And I believe it's something that African descendants and other poor people in the southern part of this country have always had to do. But the obstacles that always come into place, we've seen examples of what happened to Maurice Bishop in Grenada. Every time we move forward, going back to the Haitian Revolution, every time we move forward, we take a step to make ourselves free, to liberate ourselves, to again become self-sufficient and independent. The powers that be make a point of crushing us. And the nature of the obstacles range from everything from sanctions that are imposed on people to systematically boycotting the products that they produce, creating tariffs that are prohibitive, flooding the products of the West, of the global North, and in the South, in the Southern, the geographic South. We are part actually of the global South. Okay, the global South is actually the term that we use when we're talking about developing countries, so-called third world countries that are not industrialized, post-industrialized, in a post-capitalist era. So the South within the South, which is what every black and brown person is in this country, gets suppressed in different ways, and devaluing the work that is being done. The sort of psychological warfare is something that is critical. That's one of the things that we do have to look out for, so we don't get tripped up. People have been made to feel that what they do, what we produce, what our cultures teach us, what the knowledges that our ancestors have passed on to us, the knowledge that we are creating, the creativity that we have, somehow doesn't matter. You know, it has no relevance because there's no value attached to it. We have great difficulty getting people to pick the ball up and keep running with it. A classic example is in Haiti. We haven't had cholera on the island for centuries. For centuries. Why? Because voodooists, people who are practitioners of voodoo, people like myself, who is a priest of voodoo, who are taught how to live in an ecological balance with the world. That's what our traditions are about. We are taught how to use, work with the rhythms of the earth, work with the heavens, understand plant life, the environment around us, to live in harmony with it, to work with it. So because we were familiar with the plant life, the flora, the fauna of our world, our universe, because again, it's what voodoo, as not just as a religion, but as a discipline, teaches us. We are able to ward off and prevent certain kinds of maladies, certain kinds of illnesses coming to us. But because through the media, because of pulp fiction, because of the faith communities coming from the North, primarily Ibrahimic traditions, making us feel like our indigenous traditions, our indigenous knowledges didn't mean anything. They weren't worthwhile. Our community, Haitian nationals, began to discard that knowledge, ignored it. And then that formula of, on one hand, rejecting your knowledge, rejecting your culture, and then the bombardment and the sheer nastiness of people who came from the outside of the country, creating conditions that allowed cholera to develop and grow and kill thousands of us, created a perfect storm. So this is there are actual biological, environmental, ecological issues that we face in trying to realize our objectives. And there are the psychological issues that are manifestations of racism, racial discrimination, of what we call Afrophobia, this fear of the people, the culture, the sensibilities of African descendants. And Afrophobia is not a problem that we deal with somebody outside of our racial group imposing on us. Afrophobia is internalized as well. That's the scariest part of it. When we reject our own vision, our own knowledge, when we reject our own capacity to develop ourselves and to sustain ourselves, when we do not recognize ourselves and we don't understand and recognize that justice is due to us as well. So those are the obstacles, and so we got to be clear about everything that we face and put a system of checks and balances in place to offset the kinds of attitudes, the infrastructure of hate, if you will, that we're always up against. So we have to persevere. I mean, I'm going to say something, and I'm not going to be wearing my cap as a human rights person, a human rights activist representing a group of NGOs. I am speaking personally and privately now. I feel that we have been, what did Malcolm say about hoodwinked and bamboozled into thinking that integration was the best thing for people of color in this country? It really wasn't. It really wasn't. Segregation had all kinds of issues, but from an economic perspective, it really allowed black communities to thrive and grow in ways that they haven't been able to since the 60s and the 70s. Because our dollars kept circulating within our communities. You know, it made that dollar stretch 20 times. Now it only stretches maybe 3 or 4 times in our community. And so the work that's going on in the South, the work that we're talking about is going on in Jackson, it is imperative that we all support it. You know, we have to support it because if we don't, we won't have a concrete example of a kind of methodology that could be put in place, tools that we can use, modify, and apply elsewhere, because what they're doing in Jackson is what, again, many of us who have passed who live in the global South to survive.
Absolutely.
Yes. It's you really hit on I think the nerve, you know, and the nerve of our people is the love and trust for each other. And in the absence of that demonstrated love and trust, people won't, you know, we won't work together. We won't have collective economics or collective work and responsibility. We won't do things in a way that's going to support the group. And that is, at the heart of it is the destruction of our social structure that supports the economic structure. So now we're moving into I think the heart of the matter, and that is a healing conversation. So I'm going to start with you, Dawoodi, again, and say, what is the healing? What kind of healing do we need right now so that we could start to see these economic circles, start to see these education circles, start to work together as a people? Because we know, as you pointed out, we can do it because we did it before. Under these conditions, we had a mixed economy where you had, if you will, the upper class, middle class, low class, black people all working together with different skill sets, but we knew each other, we lived together, we were interdependent, and it worked. We worked it out. We were interdependent. Now we think the only thing we can do about the so-called hood is to leave it as soon as possible. So then you have a predominance of uneducated, you know, people who are looking for answers without the leadership. And of course, we have to talk about COINTEL in terms of that. But right now, the question is on the floor, the healing. What kind of healing do we need right now?
It's a four-letter word. It's L-O-V-E. All right? We forget about love. Love is the most powerful tool we have for healing. You know, I just came back. I accompanied a group of students that I work with in Mount Vernon to the Kerry Marshall exhibition that's at the Met Bruyere in New York City. And Kerry Marshall is an artist of African descent who decided he wanted to be an artist and decided that when he grew up, he was going to use one color to make people, and that color was black. So everybody in his paintings are black, and I mean literally black. But part of what he did in a wide range of works that depict, you know, everyday life was to focus on black love. So you got all these images of black people hugging on each other, kissing each other, loving each other. We don't have enough of that. We don't express love for each other publicly that way. We got to do that. Our children need to see. They need to see us loving each other in a positive way. We need to love ourselves and love ourselves enough to want to fight for the things that we believe
in.
Thank you. Love ourselves enough so that, you know, we protect not just our communities, our families, but our communities as well. I mean, we can't make that great leap to Pan-Africanism, which is about the love of what? Of us, our culture, our people. We can't make that political and sort of a conceptual leap into seeing all of us as one beautiful people if we don't begin with ourselves. We got to enter into a space of wellness, of embracing who we are and being able to find and identify that, you know, we are good. You know, we just good. I remember when I was a kid and I came to this country and I was missing Haiti. And I thought about everything I loved was black or brown, you know, from the ebony skin of my grandmother to the coconut tablets that I ate, to the cinnamon, to the dark honey, to the anise, to the brown sugar, to the coffee that I had. Everything I had that I loved was black or brown. and it came from a place of goodness. So, you know, internalizing those kinds of ideas, I think are important tools, because once you understand what a beautiful human being you are, that you're not just made in God's image, you are God, okay? You are God's manifestation, you know, if you will. You are the manifestation of the most beautiful energy in the universe. When you begin to do that, then everything else that comes at you, all those other obstacles that are man-made, that are based on economics and sense of class and perception of somebody better than you, no one can defeat you. No one can defeat you because you know how powerful you are. And sharing that love, that idea of Ubuntu, that I exist because you are, you know, is something that we talk about, but we don't always practice. And so we need to get back to a very fundamental way, a very African way, a very indigenous people's way of seeing how we connect, how our lives enrich and better each other. I think fundamental to overcoming all these obstacles, and knowing that we are going to be victorious in the end.
All right, now, okay, Sister Noel, the question: what kind of healing do we need?
I think the healing. When I think of healing, I think about truth as a way of healing. So there's a lot of truth that needs to be shared between people that can bring about healing and truth can be in the form of cultural processes. It depends on who is engaged in the process of healing and the intentions behind healing, and how the healing should also lead to something much larger as a system change. So to me, that's how I would envision healing, because when I say that, I'm thinking of myself as a Dalit woman, and what does it look like for my people in India who have been oppressed by the caste system for thousands of years, and yet when I'm here, you know, there is that level of slight privilege that I have within that model minority myth that continues to move us, and how that gives me so much room to move between privileged communities and not so privileged communities. So, and truth matters in that space, and truth, sharing truth or navigating truth and using truth as a way to culturally build relationships with each other brings about its own way of exuding healing energy towards each other. To me, food is healing. To me, truth is healing. To me, being able to love one another through food and through truth-telling is healing. That's all I can think of.
Mm. That's a lot. That's a lot. Ed, so it's up to you now, brother.
I think healing comes in the process of seeking the truth, creating meaning, and transforming the world. I don't think that we can rely on an idea that we're going to transform each other first and then we're going to go out and change the world. I think that the actual transformation comes by engaging in that process. Some of the most beautiful changes I have ever seen in people were when they had an opportunity to be creative and through their own efforts brought new beauty and new meaning into the world. And certainly any efforts to transform the world are about creating meaning and new beauty, as well as helping to supply the needs that we know that we're capable of. So whenever we can engage people, I worked with a group of young folk one time. It was a jobs program. There weren't any jobs. I didn't know that beforehand. But part of what I saw in the course of it was we got some young folk out, you know, digging in the dirt. And some of us were a little afraid, like, these folks aren't going to want to get their hands dirty. And they loved it because they realized that they were in an early stage of working with some folks around producing some food. And it was transformative. That the real transformation, again, is around engaging people in doing some of the things that need to be done for our community. And I think that's where real healing and transformation will take place.
Mm. Okay. Let me share with you something that I've been privileged, if you will, to come to me as inspiration. It's called Saba Uhuru, Saba Ujiji, the Seven Freedoms and the Seven Villages. And if you take the first letter of each of the words, it's Susu. So we're talking about a Susu healing circle process. And some of you know that Susu is, by many names, self-affirmation, self-reliance, self-funding, where, you know, you can have a group that partakes in its turn every time it goes around. It could be on a weekly basis, it could be on a monthly basis. And these practices have helped us in many ways on the continent, in the Caribbean, and even so to some very small extent here. However, the only way that these Susu circles can work in America, I think, is it has to be slow and has to be on three levels. The first level is the level of familiarity, having circles of people come together and share who they are and share their vision and their intended contribution. That's the first level. The second level is then to share resources, in which, in terms of talents, not money, but in terms of talents, in terms of skills, in terms of information, in terms of guidance. And then the third level, after you people have kind of entropy fallen away, who's not serious, you know, either by intent or ability, so the people who remain have the familiarity, they have the longevity, and now they are able to do perform in this way of sharing in some circles. And if we do that, we can bring back the trust, we can bring back the predictability, we can bring back the love. And if you have one Susan, but the key factor here is that you create a chair that is a business chair. So if you have nine people, you create a chair of a Susan, and everybody will put in whatever money to make the circle whole. And every circle itself decides who's going to get the business Susu for that go round. And this is after discussion. Now, remember, you've already been in the circle, you know who people are, you know what their proposals are, and they agree or no, we're going to fund this business enterprise. And it could be something as, you know, a neighborhood grocery, you know, where the person goes to the market, gets a whole crate of tomatoes, brings them back and sells it to everyone, where he makes a small profit and the people actually get a good. So it's starting to work it on a very small scale, a very micro scale, and then you build up. So you have one susu, then you can have two, then you can have four, then you can have a regional susu. So this, you know, it's just, I just gave you a brief idea of what this Saba process could be in terms of building our people from the ground up. So if anybody would like to comment on these ideas and share what is happening in the circles that you're connected with, we'd certainly like to hear that. Any comments on that proposal?
Hello?
Brother Najee?
Yeah, your mic is still a little problematic, Robin. Unfortunately, the line is not giving us a clear voice pattern.
All right.
So we still have, unfortunately, some difficulties with Robin's line. But to Noel, to add to Dawoodi, the idea of a Saba Uhudum Saba Udija project, how does that sound to you? I'll start with Ed.
You know, since I've first been made familiar with them, I think the whole idea of Susu is just really important. One of the things it means is that people don't have to wait for somebody else to allow them to do something that even reaches beyond their means, because you have this collective group that's engaged with each other, and the many can support the one, and then the one remaining part of the group becomes part of the support for another one, and at some point everybody has been supported and people are able to do things beyond what they would have ever been able to do as individually. So again, this is one of the processes by which we can cooperatively engage in an activity that that helps to foster us being productive. I've heard of people using it to buy a sewing machine, and then somebody starts a sewing, and then somebody else, or you can use it to buy a cow or to buy, you know, a few goats, you know, all depending on what is appropriate in the setting that you're in. So I certainly think that this is a viable way. You know, there's some people talking about developing savings clubs so that that we can all be part of putting together the resources that we all use to, in order to be productive and self-sustaining. And I think it's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Sister Noel?
I do not know much about it. I was just listening earlier, but I mean, as an idea or as a concept, it's a beautiful thing. I can think of something similar from my community that not exactly the same, but okay, I was just reflecting on certain things my grandmother has shared with me in the past. So that's my reflection for now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sister Dawoodi?
Oh, well, I grew up I'm from the Caribbean, grew up in a Caribbean household, and actually I remember when I first arrived here, my mother, whom I did not grow up with, had a susu that she was a part of, and I later came to realize that it was a means for the at least the Haitian immigrant community to sustain itself as they were making this transition in North America. Susus are something that we find again, as I said, throughout the Caribbean and on the African continent. But I have to say that the notion of the susu works best because it's part of a bigger structure called the laku. A laku, maybe if you're Jamaican, you would call it the yad. But it's essentially the community of people that you're interacting with. The reason a laku, and you're interacting with them on a consistent and regular basis, and there is a shared understanding, there is a shared a value of being present to support members of the community. The lakus will come together in to do something like if a child is going off to school and they need a parent needs money for tuition, everybody will come together and provide the money for that child. An elder dies, and monies are needed to provide funeral arrangements. Everybody comes together and makes sure that the family has that there to support them. A combit, or which is a cooperative really of farmers coming together, plowing, seeding, harvesting collectively. This idea of a more socialist or communitarian way of handling money, because there are shared values and responsibilities that are part of that, are the things that make a susu possible. So it isn't just that the susu exists by itself, but it has to have a bigger context in which it operates. So again, this system of checks and balances are there. And the other part of that is microfinancing. And Noel, I'm sure you're very familiar with that, because one of the Nobel laureates was an economist who made his name off of the construct of microfinancing. But in fact, that wasn't his idea. Women have been doing microfinancing with each other all over the world for as long as women have been around. But microfinancing works successfully because we lend money to each other, and because we understand we are working in, we are part of an ecology. It's not just a physical community, but we have this ecological relationship with each other, that we make sure that money gets paid back. And we are able to help build. You know, the sister who buys the sewing machine is able to buy cloth, to buy thread, to buy the things that she needs to from somebody else who has these things, or can get a small loan to make clothing, sell it, repay the loan back, whether the loan comes from within the community or outside of the community. But these three factors, this kind of notion of the susu, the microfinancing, and the bigger structure of the laku of community, are the things that I think have to be working in tandem with each other to make the construct of the susu that you're talking about work successfully. There's a lot of trust and accountability that is there, and to transform this idea from a smaller, like a microcosm of itself into something bigger, requires a lot of work and
the
consistent coming together of family, of community. Excuse me.
Yeah, it does.
Excellent. So,
Brother Najee, can you hear me right now?
That's much better.
Great. Thank you, Sister Dawati. Can I say a few things? I've been listening, but I haven't been able to interject. But, you know, we're at a state of crisis in terms of economics as a subject matter. I just posted recently an article about the Republicans preparing to defund the United Nations. And we're getting some feedback. And so I'm curious to know, you know, with this decade, there is a budget attached, but I always look for the organizing opportunity on a global level, be it collective economics, how we can leverage, what would be a solution that we can create what would be called a breakaway economy or a breakaway economic plan to do just what we're speaking of this evening? Because, in fact, you know, we control no industries, all less than 3.1% of the land, and we African Americans alone represent nearly the 8th richest country in the world. So I'm looking for mechanisms and how that fits into the decade. And Anaji, I love, you know, I'm familiar with what you're presenting here, but I also I'm reminded that if we in the United States, those of us of color, those of us of dais, African Americans, so-called, if we were a nation, we would be at the United Nations at the table, not at conferences, at invites, but at the table with an economic package attached. And so when we speak of reparations, I'm thinking human rights. I always think legalities. When we speak of human rights, I also speak. You're speaking of international law. And I'm wondering how, like, corporations play into this and that they're not being addressed. And they are economic largesse of our earnings and our labors, and that they do have rights as humans and personhood, and they do sue in international courts. But we don't have that commonality to come together and speak as a one voice. So I'm looking at, like, what are solutions that we can will be what I would call a catalyst for a breakaway economy, because in fact crisis, either we revert back to old behavior patterns or we take a new step forward. And so I have a lot of promise in this decade that, you know, these messages and the concepts and ideas talked about tonight can be applied in other nations amongst our people, because we do need that global approach and that collectiveness and that love. So I want to say that, and thank you, Anaji.
Thank you.
And the guests, yes.
The question that Robin is asking us, and what opportunities might exist in this period of crises, and I'm going to throw that in your direction.
I'm so glad you did, because I was going to ask if I could speak to that one. I'm normally kind of shy, but I want to talk about that. One of the things we have to remember is that capitalism actually doesn't work. It's not like it can keep on doing what it does and just get mean. Capitalism itself is going through a crisis, which is to say that the internal contradictions of it give rise to a situation where it can't smoothly develop. It grows in leaps and bounds, and that's why it needs wars. Wars of conquest and a lot of other things. So we have to kind of recognize that and play a role of creating within it things that can withstand the collapse and problems that it's going to have. And there's a gigantic financial crisis, housing market collapse, that certainly we as a part of the American economy were damaged in. But we have to start thinking about what are the things that we can build that will be somewhat insensitive to some of the financial structures and crises. That's why I don't want to build anything that's dependent on philanthropy. When you have huge fluctuations in the stock market, the amount of money that people have to give away is based on how their investments are doing, drops off sharply, and we get hurt. If, on the other hand, we were building structures inside our communities that we're recycling the money within our communities, then some of these larger things going on outside of us don't have the same kind of impact. And it reminds me of the whole process of the metamorphosis of a caterpillar into a butterfly. That caterpillar eats up everything it can, very greedy grub worm, and at some point, though, it goes into a cocoon where it begins to die, quite frankly, at the same time that some imaginal cells within that caterpillar are beginning to develop the first pieces of a butterfly. But the immune system of the caterpillar is still there, and it keeps attacking these imaginal cells and destroying them, but they keep reforming and regrouping and using the caterpillar basically as food to do it with. And after a while, this keeps on going, and it looks kind of bleak for both sides, but we all know what finally happens. A butterfly comes out. The caterpillar is no more. The caterpillar became the food that the butterfly was born out of. So we have to recognize that it's not like capitalism just will sit here and we have to figure out how we're going to build something inside it that's just as strong or as big as it is. We have to realize it's dying. Right now we are actually witnessing, and it's kind of amusing to me if you think about it this way, we're actually witnessing in the United States the collapse of the Republican and the Democratic parties. Now, wounded beasts are very dangerous. You don't want to get close to them when they die. But on the other hand, if you can kind of stand back and watch them, it's kind of funny because they're going through death throes. And if you think about the confusion that both the Republican and the Democratic parties are in right now, if you think about the fragility of the economy right now, then you know why it's really, really important for us to start building economic structures that are rooted in our communities and that are determined to be connected to a different set of principles, not the principle of constantly expanding money, which is all this economy is about, but rather the principle of meeting needs and elevating the quality of life. So I think when you say, you know, we're at a crisis, we have to start doing something different, I absolutely agree. And what that different thing is reorienting an economy that is a humane economy based on the human principles about meeting our needs and elevating the quality of life of our people, of creating use values rather than creating exchange values. And on the basis of that, we will have something that can outlive this dying system and become that beacon of hope that the people who are caught up in that collapse will be looking to when they say, well, you know, in their turmoil, like, what can we do? It's like, you can do this. You can do this. This is going to work for us. So perhaps one of the kinds of things we can start looking to is some of the intentional communities that we can create around food, housing, and cultural productions. I'm talking about having enough food to eat, a place to stay, and a meaningful life that you're actually capable of enjoying, that again is not rooted in having all of the material possessions that folk will tell you you need to have if you watch all the ads that need to come up on television or in your internet Facebook feed. They'll tell you all kinds of stuff you ought to be spending money on. We need to identify again the things that we need and to make our lives meaningful and produce the kind of cultural life and the kind of economic life that is required in such a way that it's not dependent on the success of a capitalist system, so this capitalist system isn't going to succeed.
I uphold what Brother Ed just said. You know, in the Durban Declaration and Program of Action Plan, the death of capitalism was stated in between the lines. It was a critique of capitalism. Capitalism was recognized as the bane of the existence of so many black and brown people who had been enslaved, people who had been under the cloak of imperialism. And it's not an accident that, again, the issue of reparations comes up in this context, because from a financial and economic perspective, you know, that would, again, completely change the nature of the world order. And so, you know, who has actual access to money, and more importantly, the raw resources that generate the capital, is something that was raised not blatantly, but was, like I said, in between the lines of the Durban Declaration. But relative to that, how do we get those values? How do we come together as a group and have that presence that, you know, I believe what Scotty wrote or spoke of at the UN? One of the things that we're trying to do and we have to accomplish before the end of the decade, before 2024, is to have a permanent forum for people of African descent. We need to be at that table. We have a working group of experts on people of African descent that has done, at least up until 2013, but even more recently, excellent and important work articulating issues that are found in our respective countries wherever we are. But, you know, focusing here on the U.S., you know, one of the main things that was said is that the U.S. government has to provide reparations and or Truth and Reconciliation Commission for people here. That's important work. But the working group of experts is not overwhelmingly people of African descent. Is a working group of experts for people of African descent, but many of them historically have not always been in the majority. And a lot of times, even when there were significant numbers of people, we haven't always been the chair of that committee. But we need more. We need more experts who are of actual African descent, much more diverse group. But over the course of the decade, we need something that is a permanent forum where we, from our respective regions, determine who our leaders are at the UN and what positions we want them to take when it comes to everything that shapes our human rights, our capacity to receive justice, to develop ourselves, to be recognized. So a permanent forum is a space where we can be sitting at that table and say, boom, this is what we want. This is what we're looking for. This is, you know, our voice is there, and it's permanent, so that people aren't getting rotated on and off, you know, because of terms that the UN mm-hmm. has determined. They will come on and off because of terms that we will determine, mm-hmm. and we can delegate tasks and responsibilities out to specific groups of delegates, if you will, on who are members of that permanent forum. We don't have that kind of control. We may have a presence, but we don't have that kind of control. It's not enough to be in the room, but we've got to be at the table, and more importantly, we need to own that table.
Mm-hmm. So you really have created the bridge as we get ready to close. So what are the goals is CERAC focusing on in the year 2017?
Brother Najee, we're on wind down. I've been notified by network. We've got like 3 minutes left, just to let you know and to thank our guests and give us a heads up for our next program.
Yeah, I think we can have a conversation about the goals another time, but one of the important things I would like for us to do is to launch an online Truth and Human Rights Commission for people of African descent, where people can go online and they can testify how they've been victimized through Afrophobia, racism, colorism, and later use that information to take it to the Office of the High Commissioner and enforce certain issues in our favor, so that we do, in fact, get recognition, justice, and development.
Okay. Sister Noel, what goals are you focusing on there in Jackson for 2017?
So we have the People's Assembly's process, ANTAR's election coming up, building of cooperatives, and also doing more grassroots organizing, education work, and repurposing our institutions, educational institutions, and cultural spaces. I think those I see are very important in people self-determining their future in Jackson and making Jackson that model that, as the sister was saying earlier, that affirms the processes that we all believe in and strive for.
Okay. Brother Ed, what things are you working on for 2017?
Well, we're working along, again, with the Southern Reparations Loan Fund. We're working with a number of groups that are about to be loan ready. One of them that's already launched a product, the Dream Defenders of Florida, who are launching a business called Rebel Threads on the basis of a completely ethical supply chain from cotton raised in Texas on a cooperative sewed by a worker-owned business in North Carolina and printed by their own members there. And so we're talking about something where nobody was being exploited and the profit of the surplus from their labor was being taken by anybody else. All of these are worker-owned cooperative entities. And so this is an ethical supply chain just to prove that that is a possibility. And that's one of the possibilities, and we're looking to build other businesses that are similar.
Folks, you heard it here on Mace Treaty. See you next week, same time, same station. Everyone, thank you so much, and good night.
I say thank you. Peace.
Oh, this you crazy mother...